Welcome back, and I now give the mic over to Ansel for a new episode of FedWatch.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another exciting episode of FedWatch. My name is Ansel Lindner, and today we have an awesome guest. Joe Carlisseri is joining us. Joe, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Ansel. Thanks so much for having me on.
Now, I think you're a perfect guest for FedWatch because we try to question the narrative, not only from the traditional financial press and all that, and the Fed, but even the mainstream Bitcoin narrative. So you have a lot of insightful content out there in Bitcoin. Your Twitter feed is, criminally underfollowed. So everyone should go over there and follow you on Twitter. But Joe, can you give the audience a quick introduction and tell us what you do in Bitcoin?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a commercial litigator. I have a practice group specialized in litigated disputes involving Bitcoin and also our friends in the broader crypto market who were trying to get to be Bitcoin only. So I help people across the spectrum in litigated disputes with a Chicago law firm of Smith Amundsen. Aside from that, I'm an armchair economist. I've been filing financial markets since grade school, trading with my father on a custodial account, and really just an avid Fed watcher. I love this show and many others, follow it very closely. And what I've tried to do basically since university, since studying economics formally, is really understand the plumbing of the financial system, understand what drives our economic markets. And I've always sort of had a knee-jerk reaction in opposition to the sort of mainstream narrative that I think that's pushed out a lot, that the Fed is at the center of the world, that they control everything, that they are, the Wizard of Oz, able to manipulate markets. To me, I don't think that's ever made a lot of logical sense. So if there's one thing I always like to question and one thing I like to contribute to Bitcoin, as you and many others do, is to get people to question, really, what is this entity? What is its force? What are its limitations? What are its abilities to actually change what's driving the heart of the economy, which is too much debt, poor demographics, and all the things that make us be inherently less productive as we were maybe even 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, I think you have a very unique perspective, especially in your job that you're doing there at the law firm. We were chatting before the show, and that's a part of the market that I never see. And we kind of worked out, maybe this is the cycle where a lot of these companies are working and finding out what is going to work with Bitcoin contract wise, miners and all this. So can you maybe fill us in a little bit more on that side of the house?
Yeah, absolutely. So, what we've seen over the last several cycles, if you call them that, is you've seen a maturation of Bitcoin, where first and foremost, you saw guys that were trying to put together mining deals, and it was very much the wild, wild west. It wasn't formalized. It wasn't something where they tried to put pen to paper and draft out real good agreements and contracts and those sorts of things. And you saw a flurry of litigation early on because, as is expected, people overpromise and underdeliver on their obligations. So it's interesting. In my line of work, in the bull market, it's amazing because you get a bunch of people excited and starting ventures and companies and trying to grow and pursue entrepreneurialism. But now everybody's mad at each other, right? You didn't give me my miners. You didn't. You stole this site out from under me. You did some inappropriate thing, and now I want to sue you. So in many ways, my line of work has been even more busy since the bear market started, because people are really frustrated and angry and feel like they were ripped off in a lot of respects. But the big takeaway, I think, is this. We're entering a precipice here where the entire Bitcoin industry is maturing, and we're evaluating this and making really smart decisions. And I think that partially was responsible for why we didn't see this blow off top that many people were expecting, Bitcoin over 200, 300. I think just you're getting market participants that are more sophisticated, both on the investment side and on the entrepreneurial corporate side. And most of the gambling, the degeneracy, the nonsense, that's kind of still, unfortunately, in the altcoin market. It's kind of dragging us down. But my view is that 5 years from now, the Bitcoin marketplace and market participants, particularly on the company side, are going to be extremely sophisticated, much more so than even now.
Awesome. That is great insight. So let's get into the macro conversation here with one thing that on Twitter that you seem to, you know, are really, you're really focusing on over the last couple of weeks is the yield curve, or maybe even last couple of months, is the yield curve. In the last 2 days, we've seen an inversion of the 2 and 10 again. So can you help us understand the yield curve and what it's telling us right now?
Yeah, in a very basic way. And I think, you know, it's like that great line from The Big Short where, you know, people in macro and finance, they like to throw out fancy terms just to the purpose of confusing you. All it really talks about when you're looking at a yield curve, particularly on the treasury market, what you're looking at is really the cost of capital, right? What is the cost of borrowing effectively? And when you see spreads between different instruments, what you should see is you should see a beautiful upward sloping curve, right? So that the more long end issuance, 30 year, 20 year, 10 year, they should always be yielding more than the short end, right? You shouldn't see the 2 year yielding more than the 10 year instrument. That doesn't make any sense because that would mean that there would be no such thing as the time value of money. So right now, to your point, we've got the 10 and the 2 inverted, and that shows you there is a problem in the credit market. Something is going on. It's sniffing out some reason why the demand for the 10 year is very elevated, but the short end, which is more responsive to Fed policy, is being artificially lifted up. So a lot of people focus on the predictive aspect of the yield curve, the fact that it can be pretty reliable in terms of a recession indicator. Once you get these sorts of inversions, like, you know, where we're inverted right now on tens and twos, I think the last time we saw that was in 2007. It was pretty good early warning sign that we might be nearing a recession. But aside from the predictive element of the yield curve, there's not enough emphasis on the prescriptive parts of it. It actually causes problems for banking institutions, lenders, companies that are trying to borrow, and you've got this really confused credit market. So from my point right here, I'm looking at the yield curve, and I think the takeaway is that the long end is fundamentally rejecting the inflation narrative. It's fundamentally saying that the long-term economic growth expectations are weak. And we know this as market participants. That's why we're bidding up the 10-year. But at the same point, the short end saying, you know what? We think these guys at the Federal Reserve and other central banks, they're for real, that they're having an influence on the short end, and we're going to react to it. So they could probably keep us artificially kept up for a little bit and until something breaks, or alternatively, maybe something doesn't break, and that we could talk about that as a potential outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about predictive versus prescriptive. I get frustrated with people trying to predict the future instead of looking at the yield curve and looking at the current situation and saying, what is this telling me about the market right now? You know, I don't care about where it's maybe telling me about 2 months or 6 months or 2 years in the future, whatever, because nobody really knows the future. But what is it telling us exactly right now? And I agree with you. I think the yield curve is telling us that there is something fundamentally wrong. A lot of people, you mentioned there about raising rates and Fed policy and stuff. Do you think that they can continue to raise rates, or is that the wrong question to ask? You know,
I think
go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry, I chomp at the bit for that. I cut you off. I apologize. No, I think that the focus on the Fed is totally wrong. It is the mistake that people are making at this point. The Fed does not have the power to control this CPI wave that we've all been struggling with in across the world. They can't, you know, like the old adage goes, they can't print more oil. They can't fix these different markets. But what I think the Fed is doing in many ways is they're focused from the standpoint of trying to influence market expectations, trying to destroy demand, trying to engineer the reverse wealth effect to prevent people from spending. And the goal behind all that is in many ways an implicit acknowledgement that they don't control what really matters for CPI, that it's beyond their ability to really generate that. So I don't particularly care very much about you know, what with the Fed's going to raise 75, 25, 50, you know, I think most of the market participants at that point think they're in full on hawkish mode, that they're going full throated to do whatever it takes to crush CPI. To me, I'm more looking at the forward indicators, and one of those is the long end of the bond market, and in particular, the euro dollar futures market. I mean, the euro dollar futures market sniffed this out perfectly last December when the euro dollar futures curve inverted, as was pointed out by Jeff Snyder and other commentators. That to me matters way more than what the Fed does, because those are real market participants managing huge amounts of capital. They're hedging. They're trying to make sure that the market, that they basically protect their finances. They protect their access to credit. They protect their ability to survive economically. Those actors, in my opinion, are far more important than what the Fed is doing. As I always say, and I probably have tweeted this out about 24 times, so apologies, Ansel, for having to read it again and again, but I always say the bond market and the larger Eurodollar futures credit market, that leads the Fed. They tell the Fed what to do, not the other way around. The Fed does not tell the credit markets what to do. They are led by the bond market and real funding issues.
Yeah, exactly. And right in your intro, you said you didn't like the idea that the Fed was in charge. So you haven't bought into the Fed mythology is what you're telling me.
No, I don't buy into it at all. I think that I use the Wizard of Oz analogy a lot, because I think as long as the wizard can convince you that he has all the power to cure everything, you know, he can make you braver. He can give you a heart. He can do whatever he needs to do in the economy, but it really is just kabuki theater. It's all psychological manipulation. QE is a psychological manipulation. You know, it is basically trying to say, well, we have this implicit backstop of unlimited power, unlimited liquidity, and we can inflate money in all markets. And it does, right? Like, there's no doubt that we've seen incredible asset inflation over the last 10 years because the market participants get the signal that is being sent by the Federal Reserve and other central bankers that we will backstop this. We have the power to stop anything that comes in our way. My question to people is, what happens when it stops working? What happens when they can't perpetually inflate markets forever, or at least manipulate people's belief that they're inflating markets? That day will come. That's the watershed moment. That's going to change everything in our game. That's going to be so bullish for Bitcoin when people finally realize that these guys you thought were in power, you thought controlled asset markets and everything else and every other aspect of the economy, they were never in power to begin with. It's just people believe they were.
What do you think about the idea that we're just following Japan's footsteps? A lot of people poo-poo that idea, but I think that, you know, Japan is our future. If we want to see where we're at in 5 years, just kind of look at where Japan is at today. What do you think about that?
I think we have structural advantages that Japan doesn't have, but I like the comment from the standpoint is I think what you should take away from the Japan parallel is that this can go on a lot longer than people think. And I know that's not what people want, especially in Bitcoin. We're all eager for hyper-Bitcoinization and to shift rapidly to the Bitcoin standard. Yes, that could happen. But it could happen a scenario where these guys keep rolling out an alphabet soup of new programs and agencies and facilities with every single downturn. And you enter into perpetual cycles of volatility. My friend Matthew Pines and Bitcoin Tina, they talk about this Fugoid cycle a lot, where you see, you know, rapid price movement, volatility, risks to the upside and to the downside. And I think that if I were my base case for the next 10 years is to expect high volatility in all financial markets, I think the days of just, you know, slow, steady movement up into the right, they're gone. And you as a market participant should expect wild volatility. And you should also expect unforeseen, unpredictable risks, many of which I think Bitcoin mitigates against quite well. And if you're interested in this, it's a Bitcoin Magazine podcast that there was a Bitcoin Magazine podcast that Bitcoin Tina and I have recorded last month with CK. I think he's still editing it, and we outline our base case for the next 10 years. That should be coming out next few weeks here. So little teaser for that.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. Now, that kind of doesn't square, though, with a post-GFC normal. So we were talking a little bit before we came on here, And my base case is just returning to low growth, low inflation, just like we've had since 2008. But the volatility that you're talking about doesn't seem to fit into that paradigm. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it does, and here's why. I think the problems are going to rear their ugly head this decade, first in the emerging world, and we may disagree on that. I'm not quite sure, Angel, your view on that, but I think that you're going to have a lot of folks that don't have the benefit and privilege we do in the United States and other Western countries of being able to control at least some aspects of our financial plumbing. These guys are much more dependent on what the West does. And in that dynamic, when you have geopolitical instability abroad and you have wild volatility in those markets, it's very hard in our system, which is interconnected, for some of that not to bleed over into U.S. financial markets. So what I would say is that volatility abroad, that's going to be the sort of the canary in the coal mine, which is going to lead into our markets, and we're going to have to respond extremely quickly to try to stabilize what's going on over there. I was in a discussion earlier today about, like, you know, is the Federal Reserve going to end up buying JGBs? Things like that. Like, those sort of questions, I think, are going to be recurring issues that we're going to have to deal with, because in my view, yes, we're going to have weak, low, anemic growth, but there's far more of a risk of a deleveraging event or a liquidation event in some of these foreign countries, emerging markets in particular, over the next 10 years.
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter there. I would think that we would just buy yen before we buy JGBs. And I think that could stabilize some of the situation over there. I totally agree. I think emerging markets are going to fall off much faster, because I think, well, the main reason why emerging markets have had the 40-year run that they've had is based on the Eurodollar system. And as that's grinding down, you know, the credit bubble will pop first in those emerging markets, and it'll work its way towards the interior. I've also talked a lot about the ECB and the euro here recently on the show with fragmentation risks. Do you have any comments on maybe some the differences faced by the Fed and the ECB?
Well, the biggest difference is this issue with their anti-fragmentation policy, where they've got, you know, countries with various different bond markets and the finances and debt levels. And this has been always sort of an uneasy alliance with the EU, how they're going to navigate this space where everybody's not Germany, right? Everybody doesn't have the strength of some of the stronger EU countries. So I think they have got a really tenuous bond there. It'd be like in the United States if Texas had the ability to had a difficulty financing something versus Illinois, right? Like, you had this myriad approach, and that the Federal Reserve is going to have different monetary policies in some states versus the others. We see a little bit of that, you know, with our state governments, but I think it's much more pronounced in the EU. So from my standpoint, I think that the EU's biggest problem is not actually a monetary or financial one. It's a political one. How to get people to in positions of authority in the EU to willing to develop different policies that are perhaps not advantageous to their own citizens for the sake of stabilizing the entire EU. That's a very difficult political tightrope to walk.
So am I reading it right that you expect Europe to have more troubles over the next few years? And my argument would be that would bolster the U.S. dollar and U.S. stock market and those types of things. Do you think we're going to see capital flight into U.S. dollar denominated assets and Bitcoin? We can tie Bitcoin in here too.
I think you already see it. I mean, given the amount of wealth destruction and the fact that you've got an S&P 500 down, what, like 20%? I mean, you're seeing all sorts of parallels between very rough times financially, and you still have elevated asset markets across the board. I mean, we haven't even gone back to the pre-COVID peak on the S&P 500 and many other markets. Yes, there's been individual stocks that have been down, but Lynn Alden has this great article called The Capital Sponge. I would encourage everyone to review it and look at the fact that the U.S. has been sucking in more and more capital globally over the last 10 years. And that's why you've seen this unprecedented rise in financial markets. So from my standpoint, I think that's already occurred. I expect it to continue. I know that there are many in Bitcoin who, you know, predict the imminent collapse of the dollar and hyperinflation and all these things. And I'm not saying that we don't get there eventually, but for the foreseeable future, if you're a capital allocator and you're going to put significant sums of wealth in a country, where are you going to put it? Russia? China? What is the alternative, right? Unfortunately, the way the system is constructed, U.S. capital markets are the biggest game in town. Maybe they lose some of that market share over the next 5 to 10 years while people, you know, they're more cognizant of the risks of seizure of FX reserves like in Russia. It's very possible. But, you know, these things happen very gradually. They don't just, you know, flip a switch and now the entire Eurodollar market is just evaporated. I think that's extremely unlikely, very low probability of occurring, if that makes sense, Ansel.
What is up, my Bitcoin plebs? Today's podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, BitMEX. If you've been in the Bitcoin space for longer than a week, then you probably already know BitMEX as the OG crypto derivatives exchange and one of the biggest supporters of the Bitcoin space in the last decade. But what you might not know is that BitMEX is launching a brand new spot exchange on the 17th of May to easily buy and sell Bitcoin and crypto. To celebrate, they're giving away $1 million in crypto to spot traders over the next few months, and they want you to be a part of it. The Bitcoin Magazine crew had the privilege of meeting their team a few months back, and they think that this is the start of something special for BitMEX and their users. Sign up at BitMEX.com today to catch a slice of the $1 million in crypto giveaway, and stay tuned to our podcast for future product offerings from their team. Again, don't miss out on the giveaway. Free sats are the best sats, so sign up today at BitMEX.com.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been fighting against the inflationist here on this show. A lot of people look at like Weimar Germany, and that lasted 2 or 3 years. And people envision a hyperinflationary end to the dollar. And I've been saying, no, this is going to be a deflationary end to a credit bubble. And I do expect a lot of capital to flee over there from Europe to the US. European stocks have not really taken a hit. I think they're even year to date higher than the US stock market. So
right.
I don't think that we have seen a ton of capital flight yet, but we'll see. That's part of my thesis, at least, is why I'm more bullish on US than Europe or China. We see a lot of similar things going on over there in China. But let's go into commodities, because when we talk about Europe, we have to talk about the energy crisis. And we have seen commodities topping, right? Some topped back in March, right after the invasion of Ukraine, but some have topped in the last few weeks and started selling off. This does coincide with the DXY screaming north. So what's your thoughts on DXY and commodities?
I think there are a lot of factors driving commodities markets right now. First and foremost, I think the biggest factor driving them is they were the place to hide. They were the trade of preference for hedge fund managers and financial actors for the last 6, 7, 8 months, perhaps even longer. People were hiding in oil stocks and energy, and they're kind of the last one to roll over as the economy approaches what looks like to be it's to be a recession. And that's very typical, right? You kind of see that last hurrah, that inflation burst you get pre-recession. But now they've all rolled over. I mean, I was looking at wheat, copper's back to like 2020 levels, and you know, oil. All these things are telling you that the base case moving forward should be slow economic growth. And that's, frankly, that's the demand destruction the Fed wanted to engage in. So you've got the first two factors, just to summarize. You've got the speculative traders who piled in saying there are commodity shortages. In many ways, the paper futures market is way bigger than the spot market for a lot of these commodities. So that adds as an artificial bid. It pushes the prices up very quickly because guys pile on because they spot that shortage and they had good intel. That's kind of falling apart now. They're bailing out of those positions. So that's going to be downward pressure. But the real economy is also a force against these high commodity prices, because that's the demand destruction. But then finally, as you point out, the dollar. I mean, the dollar at what was the DXY at? I think yesterday was 107. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
108 it got to, I think, yesterday.
108. Yeah, I mean, you know, that is catastrophic for emerging markets. I mean, it is really putting the pressure on them. To be honest, I'm actually surprised things have held together so well with some of these. I mean, again, there's a huge lag effect. The economy is not a light switch. You don't just flip something and then all of a sudden you have the consequence. The consequence can be borne out over 6, 12, 24 months. So maybe we'll see that over the next year or so. But yes, I mean, those three issues that I outlined to me tells you that the future outlook, the future narrative is going to emerge is not going to be one about high CPI. CPI can still remain elevated. Prices can remain elevated, right? But it's not going to be the burst we saw of the last year, because people are really struggling to deal with the prices and the fact that you've got a dollar that is just raging.
So CPI comes out tomorrow. Do you have any predictions on what we're going to see, an overshoot or an undershoot?
Well, you know, the White House came out and they said that they expect it to be really elevated. I think you'll see it quite elevated. I don't think that the consumer prices are going to come crashing down in the next, you know, month, 2 months, 3 months. I think that their rate of change is slowing. I think that's the big takeaway. You know, whether we have month over month of 0.3, 0.4, anybody's guess. But what I think the real growth narrative is telling you is that the economy is weak. And in a weak economy that is not subsidized with fiscal support, you could expect demand to be destroyed. So I expect that if CPI doesn't roll over soon, it should roll over somewhat. And again, we're talking about the rate of change, right? So the prices you pay at the grocery store, the prices you pay for gasoline, they could very well still remain high. But if the rate of change doesn't increase, CPI is going to go to zero. You know, for example, if you have, just think of basic, if you go and you buy your groceries and you pay for gasoline and these things, and it remains flat for a year, CPI goes to zero. Right. So I don't think with declining economic growth expectations, you should expect CPI to print again these year over year 8%, 9% numbers in 2023. You may print a higher number, or excuse me, a high number by historical standards, but it's not going to be what we saw this year.
Yeah. I try to argue with people about the price of oil. You know, everyone tells me that there's so much money printing out there. And I say, well, oil is way below where it was in 2008, right? So overall, I think we can see prices going up, but your case where it levels out to zero, I think we will see some negative prints. And the higher the CPI, you know, the lower the real GDP will be. So
right. That's exactly right.
I think that can really shake the market. That's going to shake the market more than the Fed raising rates. So like you say, the Fed is kind of impotent here. Really the recession is what's going to shake the market, I think.
Yes, I think that's right. And then the question I think that, so I think it's becoming conventional wisdom that the US is either in or headed towards a recession. I don't find many people outside of policymakers who have to deny the recession until it's impossible to deny it further. I don't see many of them denying the slowing growth. The question I think that we should all be focused on is, what does it look like if the labor market remains tight, you have slowing growth, and prices still remain elevated? What is that going to be something where the Fed, you know, everybody's dying for this quote unquote Fed pivot. Is that going to be enough for them really to move with a tight labor market, employers having, you know, this wage price spiral that the Fed seems concerned about? I don't know. I mean, I could see a scenario due to structural issues in the labor market that unemployment remains relatively, you know, low, and you don't have a massive layoffs and job cuts because people are really in high demand. I mean, my clients talk about all the time how they're struggling for good employees, particularly skilled employees. In that dynamic where you have structural low unemployment, and you have the higher prices, consumer prices, PCE in particular, and you have slowing growth, I'm wondering if the system can withstand that, if you're not going to trigger some sort of deleveraging event, which the deleveraging event, that would cause, I think, a pivot. But short of that, short of markets in absolute free fall, to me, what keeps me up at night is the fact that the system kind of just chugs along, muddles along without something major breaking. And I think that's really tough, because then you have a choice of, are you going to put your money in financial assets and financial markets that are going to underperform in that dynamic? Or alternatively, are you going to just hide in cash, which is eroding at, you know, a really high rate given the prices that are we're seeing? So it's a terrible, terrible situation for any sort of saver or investor. I would much rather something break. I would much rather there be a strong deleveraging liquidation event in financial markets, because I think that would convince them to stop messing around with this, kabuki theater that they control the CPI or control inflation.
Yeah, and that kind of makes me think of the first question that we talked about, the yield curve. Well, could the yield curve call their bluff? Because, you know, the short end being controlled more by Fed expectations, if they pushed it really negative or really inverted, you know, hardcore, even 0.5% maybe on an inversion between the 2 and the 10, that could cause something to break, couldn't it?
Absolutely. The 2 and the 10, and the one that I look at even more that I think has the better track record historically is the 10-year 3-month. Most of the original literature about yield curve's predictive ability for forecasting recessions was focused on the 10-year versus the 3-month. The 10-year 3-month spread as of right now, give you the real quote, is 74 bips, right? It's fallen significantly. It's down today about 20 bips. I want to see that invert. I mean, that to me is going to be an extremely powerful indicator. When that inverts, I think you can expect something coming in the way of new Fed policy. But, you know, it still hasn't, which means we could be still a ways away from some sort of policy change.
All right. So let's take this into Bitcoin.
Yes.
Bitcoin has had this inflation narrative for a long time. And I think we both had our own battles against the inflation narrative. I think it's very dangerous. I've talked about for a long time how once the world realizes we're actually in a deflationary environment, that, you know, Bitcoin's going to lose a bid because of all this inflation talk over the years. So are all the models dead for Bitcoin, or is there something that we can look at as a narrative in this time for Bitcoin?
Here's the narrative, Ansel, and I'm going to thread the needle here. Stick with me. So I agree with you. I mean, the fact that we still have to debate the structural deflationary environment that we're in, even if consumer prices remain high, you've got a structural deflationary environment because of the debt levels and demographics. And yep. Let me just be very clear on this. The amount of debt we've racked up in itself, even QE, as Jeff Snyder points out, they're deflationary forces, right? They are not the powder keg that would cause hyperinflation in the developed world. They suck for people paying for gas and food, but they're deflationary impulses. Debt, demographics, poor demographics, and digitization. Those three things will continue to override the whole narrative that you see in these consumer prices. And what that basically means in a very simple way is that you should expect weak, anemic, post-GFC type growth moving forward, or worse, right? Even, you know, terrible growth by historical standards. So what is going to be the inevitable conclusion there, where you have debt, poor demographics, and digitization, which is causing a deflationary pressures? You should expect long end yields to fall, okay? Consistently fall, to the point where I think I agree with former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan, where he said that it's only a matter of time in the United States before we get negative rates. Now, where does Bitcoin come into this? At a certain point, it becomes politically unacceptable and difficult to get long end yields to fall, even with this deflationary dynamic. You can get, you know, we had parts of the world that have negative rates and negative nominal rates. I think US will get to negative nominal rates. And in that environment, bearer assets become extremely attractive. the ability to custody your solution in Bitcoin in a currency that cannot be debased. That is so valuable in that dynamic, because once you get to the lower bound, you have to rely increasingly on fiscal authorities to spend money. That's why I think, and I've said this often, I think UBI is inevitable in the entire world. They're not going to let citizens starve. They're going to go further than the QE psychological manipulation. They're actually going to spend a lot of money. They discovered this during the pandemic in the United States with these stimmy checks, which were extremely politically popular. They will continue that in mass by spending more and more and more and giving it direct cash infusions to people to spend it. And this is the big thing. To light the fuse of an extreme inflationary environment, you have to give cash to people that are going to spend it instantly, like they did with the stimmy checks during the pandemic. So I think we get there. I don't think we're there now. I think that comes. And in that environment where they're giving direct cash transfers to most of the Western world, boy, that makes me more bullish for Bitcoin than anything else. I think that if the policymakers take those steps, you're going to see Bitcoin's price absolutely rip. Forget all these models that, you know, tell you worthless. I always think it's kind of, as an aside, I think it's kind of silly, these arguments that say, oh, in 2035, Bitcoin's going to be 10 million, 20 million, 30. That doesn't tell you anything, right? Like, what's the purchasing power going to be of 10, 20, $30 million in 2035? It doesn't give you any valuable market information. What I always ask is, tell me how much oil I'm going to be able to purchase for Bitcoin in 2030. Tell me how much real estate I'm going to be able to purchase. That's the key thing. So forget the dollar equivalency for a second. Look at where Bitcoin plays in this market where policymakers are forced to one conclusion, which is to spend a lot of money on the fiscal side.
Isn't that an inflation narrative, though? Like, eventually we'll end in inflation. I like to make an argument about how Bitcoin can win during the deflation. Or did I just not understand that argument?
Well, I think it can win during the deflation because of the counterparty risk elements of it, your ability to safeguard your money and keep it in cold storage and know that, you know, the Bitcoin you have self-custody over is yours and you can control its destiny. That's where I think it really it's fantastic. I mean, having to rely on third parties, I don't care what it is, stocks, bonds, bank accounts, it doesn't matter. If you can't self-custody it in a deleveraging event, in a deflationary event, it's going to be just, you know, an IOU that you can't count on. So I think it wins there, particularly in emerging markets. But I do think that the inflationists aren't necessarily wrong. They're just extremely early, and there's a whole, 10, 15 years that can play out in between there. The analogy that I'll use, and I use this with Bitcoin Tina in our forthcoming podcast, is like, imagine you're at the south end of the Grand Canyon looking across, and you know that we get across to that Grand Canyon, that it's coming, you're going to get to the other side, but you're ignoring the treacherous path in front of you, that there's a giant hole you have to navigate and make yourself through before you get to the other side. That is the way you have to look at Bitcoin right now. You can't just say, well, this is protection against hyperinflation. That we're a ways away from that, guys. There's steps in between for the dollar specifically that have to happen before that occurs.
Yeah, I just don't think the dollar can hyperinflate or inflate to a very high degree being credit-based money. I think
even with UBI?
I mean, how are they going to pay for that? They're going to borrow it, so they're going to add debt. So they net on net, it won't be inflationary. I mean, in the short term, but not in the long term. In the long term, you can't stop the credit bubble from deflating. So the end is a deflationary grind. And see, that's why I think people will go into Bitcoin, because Bitcoin, like Jeff Schneider talks about the dollar shortage all the time.
Right.
I don't think it's necessarily a unit shortage, like a dollar unit shortage. It's a shortage of monetary value. Liquid, yes. Monetary value. And if Bitcoin, or it can, you know, its market cap can expand by 100 times right now, it can fill a lot of that liquidity gap that's in the world for monetary value. So
that monetary value is credit based, right? So this is the difficulty with it, because one of the reasons he talks about like collateral shortages is because that collateral is important for, you know, rehypothecation, to generate loans, to generate credit. And, Bitcoin, unfortunately, I think is fundamentally incompatible with a credit system in the long run. I don't see a system where you have as prolific credit creation under the Bitcoin standard. You will have some, likely, especially in the near term or foreseeable future, you're going to have credit creation. You're going to have Bitcoin, you know, sort of melding here. But ultimately, when you have a bearer asset like that, a hard asset, it acts as a check on private credit creation. And the reason why I think the dollar shortage is significant right now is because what you effectively see is you see a shortage of the collateral necessary to generate credit, which is what drives the dollar shortage.
Yeah, but that is it's a problem with the form of the money.
Correct.
Yeah. So I think
which is credit, right?
Correct.
So that's our money. Our money is credit. We live in a credit-based system.
Correct. And it would solve itself if you could just let it deflate, right?
Yes.
Like we've had in the past. But we can't do that because it's all credit and it would deflate to zero. So I think Bitcoin is they will be able to push it off forever. And so I don't see a hyper deflation or a hyperinflation. That's where hyper Bitcoinization comes in before we get to either of those goals or ends.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you there. I agree with you on the conclusion. I think this can happen quickly, where Bitcoin, you know, the focus on Bitcoin at this point, I think, is sort of confused. Because I don't think most people understand Bitcoin, and that's why this show is so valuable, and your insight, Ansel, is so valuable, because to really understand Bitcoin and the unique promise of Bitcoin, you have to understand the bigger picture and the bigger global credit system. If you don't, you could be confused very easily as to why Bitcoin's important.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for the compliment, Joe. Let's get onto some. Maybe what we can see in Bitcoin specifically, one of the things I've thought about is, you know, you talked about the change in the market participant structure, you know, more professional market participants are coming into Bitcoin. But a lot of the Bitcoin narrative is based on this unbanked thing. You know, Bitcoin will bank the unbanked, and it's the plebs. And I don't have anything against the plebs. I'm one of the plebs. But should the narrative, or would it be more beneficial? Would it benefit Bitcoin if the narrative shifted to like, hey, the institutional DCA is where we need to be concentrated versus a retail side DCA? Any thoughts?
I totally think that's really wise in terms of how do we get to, you know, a 10, 20, $50 trillion market cap. It's going to be the big actors, right? And unfortunately, and I don't mean this in a belittling way, but a lot of these unbanked folks, they just live hand to mouth. They don't have a lot of capital. They're not going to be significant sources of purchasing that's going to drive us to $500-600 million Bitcoin. I'm not saying it can't help, but it's not where the money's at, right? Like the old adage, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money's at, right? You need these big players to come in and recognize what this is. Now, what I will say that I'm really excited about, and I think it isn't talked about enough in terms of a narrative, is I'm very much excited about Bitcoin and the Bitcoin network as a whole driving forward and strengthening the dollar. And Michael Saylor's talked about this a lot, but the idea that the Bitcoin network can put dollars digitally in the hands of everybody across the globe. I'm not talking about a stable coin. You could do this running on the Bitcoin network if banks and other institutions integrated the Bitcoin monetary network, the world's strongest monetary network, as a backbone. They can do instant settlements and movements of dollars abroad. The only thing that stands in their place is not a technological issue. It's a regulatory one. If you have Bitcoin loans, Bitcoin amounts of money being sent all across the developed world, those folks can get access to actually dollars in accounts as long as the regulation catches up and allows the Bitcoin monetary network to serve as the backbone for settling the transactions. It's the world's most efficient messaging monetary system in the world, and it really should, in my view, promote the dollar, increase dollar hegemony.
That's very interesting. So what is he talking about? Like color coins, or is he talking about liquid or lightning or?
No, you don't need any of that. You don't need any of that. The way you can do this is similar. It's basically a product of what like Strike does. Okay. So the way Strike sends money abroad using Lightning and other things, they have an exchange partner where, you know, if you're sending, if you, you have dollars in an account with a US regulated bank and you want to send it to your family or friends over in Europe or in any other country, what they do is you hit the button and send, and then the back end, you go from $100 USD in a banking institution, gets converted to Bitcoin, a Bitcoin USD pair. And then on the other end, it gets from a Bitcoin to Euro pair, or a Bitcoin to yen pair, or Bitcoin to any currency pair. And you've moved the funds over Lightning or Bitcoin, depending on which one the banking institution is needed, in a very short amount of time. They've got instant settlement, and they can give access to those dollars through the use of the BTC pairs with their fiat pairs into someone's account. So if you're in Zimbabwe, there's no technological reason why, if you didn't have an exchange in Zimbabwe, an exchange in the United States, and affiliated banking partners, that money can be sent to Zimbabwe for virtually nothing if the banks were to implement Bitcoin as the monetary network, the means of transacting with those Bitcoin fiat pairs.
I see.
So well, anybody could have an account, right, Ansel, with dollars, actual US dollars that are transferred using the Bitcoin monetary network, not a stablecoin.
Yeah, well, that does bring up stablecoins, though, and CBDCs. So right. I've been saying that the Fed is going to be stiff-arming a CBDC because they have Tether, but the ECB needs a CBDC because no one wants the Euro Tether. So do you have any thoughts or insights on if CBDCs are coming anytime soon and what their impact will be?
So President Biden signed the executive order where he asked the Treasury and a joint committee to look at the implications and viability of a CBDC. The Federal Reserve did their own study. The Federal Reserve study found some utility in it, but it was sort of lukewarm. It was a tepid endorsement of a potential CBDC. But importantly from the Fed is that they have been consistent through multiple publications right now that they do not believe a CBDC can be enacted absent specific legislation empowering them to do so from Congress. So what does that mean in just simple terms? It means that the Fed wants the Congress to pass a bill. They want them to specifically endorse a US CBDC. Whether that gets through the Congress anytime soon, count me as someone that's highly skeptical of that. I don't think you get anything through the remainder of this year while there's an election going on. Maybe you get an effort for some sort of digital assets bill in the lame duck. I think it's unlikely. And then you could very well have a whole new host of leaders in Congress. We'll see what they want to do, if they want to even get into a CBDC into the next session. But if the Fed is going to be resolute in their position that they want a congressional authorization to enact a CBDC, count me as someone who's very bearish on the idea that a CBDC comes to market in the US anytime soon. Europe, to be honest, I'm not as up to speed on what's going on there. I do understand why they would want to bring a CBDC to market. I continue to think that you're going to see experimentation of these things outside of the United States far earlier than you see anything with the US in terms of a CBDC.
Awesome. Great answer. Getting back to the depression question, and you've talked about this a lot in the past, the altcoins versus Bitcoin. Yeah. And you don't think altcoins are going away, but
no.
my thought is, like, is a depression going to be bad for altcoins? Cause they really derive a lot of their momentum from retail traders. And I mean, yes, I've heard you say in the past that Stimmy checks were spent a lot on stocks, and they're probably spent a lot on NFTs and that kind of thing too. But is a depression maybe somewhere where Bitcoin can decouple from altcoins?
I hope so. A knock on wood, I'm very much skeptical. I think that, we use these terms like depression, and I think to have any really good dialogue and conversation back and forth, it's important to define that. When I think about a depression, just in my mind, and I know there's technical definitions and what that really means, I look at it as a significant hard down move in financial markets, right? Where, you know, it's not 10%, 20%, 30% even down, which historically is pretty run of the mill. I look at, you know, fundamental breakage in our banking system or in the credit markets, banks refusing to lend, those sorts of activities, and also, you know, stocks in free fall. I think that prior to a quote unquote depression, you will see policymakers both on the fiscal and monetary side intervene and throw everything possible at the wall to try and get things afloat. In that environment, I think you have more of the same with the sort of COVID type impulse where you have a ton of money being spent, you have a ton of cash going into the system, and it will lift the price of everything. In particular, people that don't need that money, they're going to be investing in gambling and these stupid things. So count me as bearish on that. I don't believe the SEC understands fully the best way to go after this market. I don't think that they're going to come in and crush the altcoin market anytime soon, unfortunately, because I do think it's rife with fraud and bad actors. But what I will say is that what could cause it to change? Let's steel man the other side. What could possibly cause Bitcoin to rise in an environment where there is a depression, a hard downturn, and you have real significant inflows of capital into the market? I think in that environment, if there is uncertainty regarding counterparty risk, right? If you have capital controls on things like banks or brokerages or money markets, you have people start to really say, wait a second, I can't get access to my funds now. And I need them, and I don't feel comfortable. If that happens in mass, and I mean significant, I don't mean like one bank saying, you know, we're closed up for 12 hours and you have to, you know, get your money on Monday. I mean, it's persistent common theme where it gets into the public consciousness that, you know, wait a second, I'm being denied my hard-earned finance or financial wealth. I'm being restricted in that, similar to what was going on in Canada, right? If that happens and it becomes a regular feature, then to your point, I think that changes the game. I think that the public consciousness will pivot at that point and realize that I'm done. I'm absolutely finished with dealing with custodians for something I worked hard for to earn.
Yeah, I think it's very important that we define what a depression is because, like you said, yeah, if we're talking a massive 50, 75% sell-off in stock market and asset prices and stuff and bread lines like we saw during the Great Depression. I agree with you on everything you said there, but what about if we just see the post GFC normal again, you know, growth at 0% with the labor force participation rate increasing or decreasing, right? So unemployment might not change, but the labor force participation rate is going down. Could we be in a depression already? That yeah. It's just that recession after recession after recession.
The Emil Kalinowski, the silent depression, right? That we've been in since the great, I think he's right. I mean, like you see it with people in their reaction and ideas about work. And I think younger people, they are completely soured on the whole system. You saw people that, you know, we still are struggling to get people to return to the workforce from COVID. Since COVID began at certain levels, particularly in the minority community, we can't get people back in to think that this economy gives them a real shot. So yeah, I think you can make a case that the silent depression is here and that it's been here for a while. And I know there are people, I deal with them all day long on Twitter that say that this is the big one, the big collapse. Well, what if we've been living in it for the last 5 years? And it's, you know, it's the slow boil of the frog, right? And I think that to me, I'm very sympathetic to that view. I think that's far more likely than people tell you.
All right, so we're coming up on 5 minutes left. So let's, I would love to just summarize, what are some narratives Bitcoin can count on going forward in these times where, you know, we're facing recessionary pressures and we could be going into a global recession, very big down moves coming. The future for Bitcoin doesn't look bright, at least in the near term.
I disagree.
Term, right? In the near term,
I disagree.
Okay, so what can we take the going forward? What are some new narratives to summarize those here?
I think one of the major new narratives that every single Bitcoiner should focus on is how important being able to self-custody your Bitcoin is. The unconfiscatable nature of Bitcoin, as Tone Vase coined that term, I think. I think it's spot on. I think it's probably the most important feature because you and I both know that when these policymakers realize that they are woefully unable to deal with the real forces driving the economy, which we've talked about at length on the show, they will throw anything they can at it to try to get control. They will throw confiscatory policies at it. They will create new rules about everything from 401ks, IRAs, everything that's a traditional feature and tenet of our financial market. Yeah, ETF. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, you know, so many Bitcoiners clamoring for the ETF. I'm like, I'm so glad there's no ETF. I think it's fantastic because it gives us more of a runway to get people to understand and self-custody their Bitcoin. I hope every day that we, you know, if you want to do something as a Bitcoiner, just teach one person how to self-custody their Bitcoin in a responsible, realistic way. Everybody can do that. It costs nothing but your time, and you can help Bitcoin prosper. That alone is the most bullish thing about Bitcoin. And once you get people to realize the power of having control over your own sovereignty and your own coins, the fiat value of Bitcoin, the fiat exchange rate, it almost becomes immaterial in a lot of ways. I mean, it's just like, wait a second, this is unlike anything else out there. Any other asset, real estate, bonds, stocks, everything, even gold and dollar bills, right? Under your mattress, somebody was saying in the chat, that's terrible. I don't want to sit and live with, you know, significant sums of money and cash underneath my mattress. I mean, that just seems totally unreasonable for the internet age and irresponsible in many ways. Now, a multi-sig solution for safeguarding my wealth, I'm comfortable with that. I sleep like a baby with a multi-sig set up in a correct way. And once people realize that, in the markets where there are going to be governments that are clamping down hard, I think that, you know, don't worry about the Bitcoin price and exchange value. It's going to rip.
Awesome. So where can people find you, Joe? Where can they follow your work? You appear on a lot of different podcasts. So where can people find you?
Yeah. So I run a podcast with Neil Jacobs called Inside Bitcoin. We try to do weekly episodes just talking about the news. I'm on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter. I try to post informative content and challenge narratives that are out there. If you appreciate that kind of stuff, I'd appreciate a follow. If you have a litigated dispute, which I don't talk about enough in Bitcoin, you know, someone broke a contract, breached a fiduciary duty, committed a tortious conduct against you, reach out to me through my law firm. I'm happy to chat with you at no cost to see if you have rights that were violated. Or if you're an entrepreneur building a business, I try to help anybody. You get the Web5 discount for working with me to build out Web5. I love supporting Bitcoin. So, and then also, I'm going to tease my podcast that CK is putting together with Bitcoin Tina. That's coming later this month, I think. I would appreciate if you give that a listen. I think you'll find it informative. And Bitcoin Tina is fantastic. Follow him too. And follow Ansel.
Absolutely. Thank you, Joe, so much for coming on. We're going to have you back on because a lot of this stuff, like the yield curve and, you know, just the entire euro dollar system, we need to dive in and understand that better. And I think you are as expert as anybody that we could get on. So hope to have you back in the future. For you guys out there, you can follow me at Ansel Lindner. You can check out bitcoinandmarkets.com and sign up for my free Friday newsletter. Comes out over all the sectors of Bitcoin, including just a market commentary, a price analysis, and mining sector. And that's it. Back to you guys in the studio.